From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
A new president at the UN. New diplomacy or more of the same? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The UN opened another session. More than 120 leaders heard President Obama's first address to the General Assembly. The leaders of Russia and China will also take center stage inside, and crowds outside will protest Iran's President Ahmadinejad. Mr. Obama described his differences from the Bush administration, laid out what he called four pillars of foreign policy. We'll hear what he said about Iran and North Korea, Middle East peace, and the responsibilities of all nations. We'll hear how they are responding. On Reporter's Notebook later on, will U.S. forces in Afghanistan be increased or scaled back? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. President Obama has made his first address to the UN General Assembly with more than 120 other world leaders on hand. We'll talk about some of the highlights. On Reporter's Notebook, Vice President Biden reportedly wants to scale back U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Is basic strategy under review? First, this news update. President Obama told the UN today that misperceptions have led to what he called an almost reflexive anti-Americanism, which he said too often has served as an excuse for collective inaction. He said all nations must take responsibility for a global response to global challenges.
The time has come to realize that the old habits, the old arguments, are irrelevant to the challenges faced by our people. They lead nations to act in opposition to the very goals that they claim to pursue, and to vote, often in this body, against the interests of their own people. They build up walls between us and the future that our people seek. And the time has come for those walls to come down.
Harvey Morris is U.N. correspondent for the Financial Times. Thank you very much for joining us today.
A pleasure.
You have described what we all heard today as a stern message. Why do you use that phrase?
Well, I think, you know, among the expectations that a lot of people had from the speech was that Mr. Obama was somehow going to come and pat everyone on the back and say he was very pleased at the cooperation he's receiving. He made a much more forceful statement, which is that, you know, there has been this tide of anti-Americanism in the past. So now that he's there and he's reached his hand out to the international community, it really is up to them to respond in kind.
How did the UN delegates and heads of state respond?
Politely. There was applause at the end. I mean, it wasn't overwhelming. There was no standing ovation. And items in the speech were applauded, but it was all a very polite affair rather than a euphoric one. I mean, the president did say that he understood the expectations that had accompanied his election, but then he went on very rapidly to remind the audience that neither he nor the United States could carry all the burden themselves.
If he didn't meet expectations, what's the significance of that? Does it mean the speech will go down better or not as well as he might have hoped?
I think it will generally go down well. He's being a little bit optimistic if he really believes that reflexive anti-Americanism is dead at the UN just because he's now the president. I think this is a process rather than a rapid change, and some of the problems that that haunted his predecessors are still there to be resolved.
Well, what about those, and how different did he approach those various problems than his predecessors, particularly George Bush?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at this week, the main occasion before today was the summit on climate change, where he struck a much more engaged tone than his predecessor would have done. Nevertheless, there was a sort of absence of new ideas from the U.S., mainly because he's constrained a bit by having to wait for the Senate to approve legislation on climate change. So he's in a position where he has all the right intentions, but for various reasons, it's not very easy to act swiftly on those.
So do you think that some significant portion of the General Assembly and the heads of state themselves were disappointed in what they heard?
I don't think disappointed, really. I don't think anyone expects any big changes on the major issues soon. After all, in foreign policy, President Obama presents a very different style, but in substance, not too much has changed so far.
To what extent do you think was he addressing the American people today? All leaders presumably have to speak to their own constituencies as well as those abroad.
Well, I think you're right there. There was definitely an element of that. I think the American public don't want him to see the president coming to the UN cap in hand, because there are grave suspicions about the nature and functioning of the UN within the US. And he very firmly said that he made no apologies for defending America's interests when that was what had to be done.
Did he mention what's upcoming, particularly his chairmanship of the UN Security Council tomorrow?
He did. I mean, he's going to be chairing a session on nuclear nonproliferation, and he did put the threat of proliferation at the top of his list of challenges facing the world. So that very much set the scene for tomorrow.
He was followed by Mr. Gaddafi of Libya. He spoke for a very long time. Did the American delegation stick around for that?
There were members of the American delegation, but Mr. Obama, who has lots of other engagements this week, made his speech. Politely shook hands with Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General, and with the Libyan President of the General Assembly, and took his leave. And then Mr. Gaddafi went to the podium, which he then proceeded to occupy for just over an hour and a half.
Harvey Morris with the Financial Times. Many thanks for being with us. More in a moment on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman, only back with To the Point. Still with us, Harvey Morris, UN correspondent for the Financial Times. There was some conversation about the possibility that President Ahmadinejad might try to have a face-to-face confrontation with President Obama today. He, Ahmadinejad, is scheduled to speak much later. I gather he was present for the president's speech. Was there any effort on his part to move closer to the president of the United States?
No, not that I was aware of. I think he's saving his fire for later on in the day, although given the length of Colonel Gaddafi's speech, it may not be until about 6 New York time before he mounts the podium. I don't think President Obama will be anywhere near by that stage.
You are inside. There are presumably a considerable number of protesters gathering outside. Do you expect them to have any impact at all on what goes on inside the chambers?
No, it's a fairly regular phenomenon outside the UN, and of course there's a massive presence of police and secret agents around, so I think that they will remain very well behaved.
And we're looking for the presidents of Russia and China. They're also going to deliver their first addresses to the General Assembly. Any expectations there?
I think the Chinese president's speech will be interesting. It's his first visit, in fact, by a Chinese president to the UN. He's already signaled that China is prepared to change its attitude on climate change, maybe to help cut emissions. So he's rather set the tone for something rather positive when he comes on.
And back to the president of Iran, there's some talk that Canada will boycott his speech. Do you think other countries will do the same?
Well, I would anticipate that Israel would, and I think that Germany has said that if there's any repetition of comments he's made in the past about the Holocaust, that they will also withdraw.
And it's reported that the Russian delegation may, in fact, be considering sanctions against Iran, after all, for its nuclear development. Do you think there's much substance to that?
Well, you know, Russia has supported sanctions against Iran in the past. What has been held against Russia by its Western partners is that they've limited the measures that have been taken against Iran. Russia has tended to soft pedal on this issue. And it may well be, if there's no further progress in having a dialogue with Mr. Ahmadinejad, that the Russians will come on board.
Is the tone, is the atmosphere at the UN, because of all of these new heads of state, even though the issues, as you indicated, are pretty much the same as they've always been, is the atmosphere any different than it is usually?
It's rather a bigger affair this year, and I think that's largely down to the fact of President Obama coming. It's his, obviously his first speech as President of the General Assembly, and it has raised a lot of expectations. And there are an awful lot of crises facing the world. As you say, they may be the same ones, but some of them appear to be graver than they may have done in the past.
Well, Harvey Morris, once again, many thanks for being with us today.
A pleasure.
UN correspondent for the Financial Times. President George W. Bush was skeptical about the United Nations. He reluctantly asked for a resolution that allowed his attack on Iraq. President Obama said that in his first 9 months, he's taken a different course.
We have also reengaged the United Nations. We have paid our bills. We have joined the Human Rights Council. We have signed the Convention of the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. We have fully embraced the Millennium Development Goals, and we address our priorities here in this institution.
Edward Mortimer is Senior Vice President of the Salzburg Global Seminar. He was Chief Speechwriter for UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. And Mr. Mortimer, good to have you on our program.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be back with you.
It is nice to have you back. As we just heard the president say, he has made some gestures toward the United Nations. We heard some applause about paying the bills and joining the Human Rights Council. How differently different does he seem to you from his predecessor, George W. Bush?
Well, I think unquestionably there's an enormous difference in the mood music, and there's a... Two things. I mean, I think in the case of the bills, it was Bush did, in fact, at least partly pay the bills as a result of the Helms-Biden agreement when he first came into office. But Obama has got Congress. Of course, he has a strong majority in Congress for the moment, which gives him a considerable advantage. He's got Congress to act on that. The Human Rights Council is a direct reversal of Bush's policy. I mean, that John Bolton was the Bush's ambassador at the time when the Human Rights Council was started, and managed to lead the administration into voting against it with only three other states, a rather curious kind of victory for American diplomacy. So I think that this is very symbolic of the difference of the Obama approach, which is rather than boycott things, you try to engage and see if by cooperation, dialogue, participation, you can't get a better result. Of course, it will take time to see whether a better result is in fact achieved. And as Harvey Morris said, I'm sure Obama doesn't imagine, and he certainly shouldn't imagine, that anti-Americanism has disappeared overnight because he's the president of the United States. But I think he at least has put some of the anti-Americans on the back foot, and that's a great start.
What about, though, that reflexive anti-Americanism that the president acknowledged? We just heard that not all of that is going away by any means. What sorts of things might trigger it?
Well, I mean, of course, it's very easy to look around the world and say, well, how different in substance are the policies of the new administration from the old one? Because America has interests, and it also has, you know, a very large military and political and bureaucratic establishment, and it's, you know, in many respects, it's like turning around an oil tanker. It's not something you can do that easily. You can't, much as you might like to, just snap your fingers and make the Iraq war not happen. It's, I mean, I think he has been able, perhaps partly because of the timing of his arrival, he's been able to put a reasonably good face on that. In the case of Afghanistan, he's in a much bigger difficulty, and I noticed that he didn't really dwell on that in the speech. I think the where he has really tried to make a change, and it is a significant one, is in dealing with the Arab-Israel dispute. But even there, you could say that so far it's been mainly words. He hasn't really got much, and he's got practically nothing in the way of substantive concessions from the Israeli government. And the question is, you know, will he be able to stick to his guns? Stick to his withholding of guns, because he, you know, in the past, I think the only way that American presidents have been able to get Israel to conform with their views when there was a disagreement is by withholding or making it clear that they're willing to withhold assistance. And I think, you know, that takes a great deal of political courage, because there can be high domestic political costs for it. I think Obama has done remarkably well, and again, timing may have helped, in getting, you know, many more Americans publicly to support his policy in the Middle East. You know, even a very pro-Israeli congressman like Gary Ackerman of New York has come out in favor of a settlement freeze. So I think things are changing, but it's certainly any president is going to watch his back very carefully when dealing with that issue. You saw that in the campaign when, I think, June of 2008, Obama made his famous speech to AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, in which he really went over the top in saying he would recognize Jerusalem as the eternal and undivided capital of Israel. He backpedaled on that pretty quickly. But this illustrates how very much aware he is of the danger of appearing to be anti-Israel in terms of American public opinion. So I think he's been quite brave, and so far he's got away with it, but he hasn't yet achieved a real change on the ground.
Edward Mortimer, again, former speechwriter for the former U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan. Also today, the president touched on four major international themes.
Today, let me put forward four pillars that I believe are fundamental to the future that we want for our children. Nonproliferation and disarmament, the promotion of peace and security, the preservation of our planet, and a global economy that advances opportunity for all people.
David Bosco is Assistant Professor of International Politics at American University in Washington. He's author of The Five to Rule Them All, the UN Security Council, and the Making of the Modern World. Professor, good to have you on our show.
Thanks for having me.
What did you take from the president's speech today, particularly in terms of the contrast with President Bush? We certainly didn't hear that, did we, in the four pillars we just heard listed?
Well, I think those four pillars are not necessarily controversial and not terribly novel. Certainly President Bush focused on nonproliferation broadly. Peace and security is, of course, a very broad goal. The environment, obviously the Obama administration has put more emphasis on that, and particularly on the climate change question. And the global economy is something that any American president is going to have to worry about. But I agree with Edward Mortimer in the sense that the mood music has changed considerably via for example, joining the Human Rights Council. But even on an issue like nonproliferation, and President Obama will tomorrow chair the UN Security Council on that question, what he's done is he's linked together nonproliferation and disarmament. And that's important because what he's saying to the world is, we understand that there is a perception of a double standard here, that a lot of countries see essentially the nuclear powers on the Security Council telling the rest of the world that they can't get nuclear weapons. So he understands that rankles a lot of people, and not just, you know, Ahmadinejad and others, you know, who are actively pursuing nuclear weapons, but, you know, it rankles people generally. And so he's linked those two issues and said, we understand that we have a responsibility to disarm as well. And so he mentioned in his speech, for example, negotiations with the Russians on reducing stockpiles of weapons. And I expect that during the Security Council session tomorrow, he will really try to say that we are going to try to be a responsible citizen as well.
Today he also mentioned those two other countries that are so much a part of the controversy over proliferation right now. Here's what he had to say about them.
But if the governments of Iran and North Korea choose to ignore international standards, if they put the pursuit of nuclear weapons ahead of regional stability and the security and opportunity of their own people, if they are oblivious to the dangers of escalating nuclear arms races in both East Asia and the Middle East, then they must be held accountable.
Professor Bosco, back to you. What chance does he have, do you think, of getting Russia and China and other countries involved to hold accountable, as he put it, and also I'd like to ask what he means by that, Iran and North Korea?
Well, I think here is one of those issues where he finds himself in a very similar position to the Bush administration, in that in the Security Council, he and his team will be working with the Russians and the Chinese, and they are the principal obstacles on this issue, to support measures. Now, there has been a story recently that, as you mentioned, that Russia may consider additional sanctions. And a lot of people in Washington were wondering whether there may not have been a quid pro quo here in terms of the missile defense in Eastern Europe, that perhaps Russia had agreed, all right, we'll tighten sanctions in the Security Council if you'll rid us of this troublesome missile defense program. So that's a hopeful sign that perhaps Russia will acquiesce to tougher sanctions. But I think he's going to have a hard row to hoe here. I mean, Russia and China see the question of nonproliferation differently. They do not perceive North Korea and Iran as threats in the way that the United States does. I don't mean to say that they are happy with the idea of them having nuclear weapons, but they simply have different priorities. And Russia obviously has strong economic interests with Iran and has been actively helping their civilian nuclear program. So there are real differences in priorities and real differences in policy there that it's going to be a long struggle to overcome and to bridge.
Edward Mortimer, we just have a minute before we need to go to a break, but let me ask you, when we talk about quid pro quos, the Russians, of course, have denied that there was any such thing. But does that often happen? Do countries make agreements in advance, and then at the UN you see before you the sort of the dramatization of what's happened behind closed doors?
Well, that often is the case, indeed. I mean, but there are also, I think, there are often quid pro quos that are not quite explicit. You know, that it might be awkward for either or both sides to actually say, I am going to do a deal with you on this. But at the same time, you would know what the other side was likely to do, and that would enter into your calculations.
What would you expect to happen with the President of the United States chairing the UN Security Council tomorrow on nonproliferation? Will there be anything dramatic that happens, or will people just get up and state their positions?
I think that people will get up and state their positions. I mean, you know, you don't have new agreements or resolutions adopted at this kind of meeting. There may be some agreed statement, but if so, I think it will have a certain motherhood and apple pie quality to it. But I think it is nonetheless very significant that the President of the United States has never chaired a meeting of the Security Council before. It's a bit of luck that they happen. The United States has the presidency in this particular month, but it's an opportunity. But Obama has chosen to use it for that purpose. And indeed, the fact that he puts non-proliferation and disarmament, and I think the connection is very important, as Professor Bosco said, as the first of his four pillars. Many people might say, well, you've got peace and security, isn't disarmament and non-proliferation part of that? But no, he wants that to be seen as his sort of number one message, and I think that's quite significant.
We'll be talking about that on our program tomorrow at great length. Edward Mortimer, again, former chief speechwriter for Kofi Annan when he was Secretary General. David Bosco, professor at American University. We'll return, continue this conversation in a moment on Reporter's Notebook. We'll talk about Afghanistan. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Norman Olney back again with To the Point, talking today about the President's President Obama's first address to the General Assembly of the United Nations. Other chiefs of state also will be making their debuts there, including the presidents of Russia and China. We talked a bit a moment ago about the Middle East situation. The president said yesterday's meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinians made some progress, but today he asked for much more.
We continue to call on Palestinians to end incitement against Israel. And we continue to emphasize that America does not accept the legitimacy of continued Israeli settlements. The time has come to relaunch negotiations without preconditions that address the permanent status issues, security for Israelis and Palestinians, borders, refugees, and Jerusalem.
Again, the president is speaking about the Middle East. John Alterman is director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. He was a State Department official in the first administration of President George W. Bush. John Alterman, good to have you on our program.
It's good to be with you again. Thank you.
Does this appear to have been something of a leap to the permanent status issues when other, what the president referred to as the preconditions, haven't been arrived at?
I'm not sure it was a leap. There was some speculation that there would be an American plan that he would put on the table, and we're clearly not at that point. I think in many ways this is a leap to back to where the Bush administration had left things at Annapolis, which is let's try to see what we can do on the final status things, and that didn't really go very far.
What about getting the Israelis to stop the settlements? Do you think that the administration has given that up?
I don't think they've given up the desire to do it. I think what's happened is they've been outsmarted by an Israeli prime minister who thinks that now is not the time to do that. I think the president is extraordinarily hurt by the fact that his standing in Israel has plummeted. He probably has single-digit approval ratings in Israel, and I don't see a way to move Israel toward a more active negotiating stance when Israelis virtually universally distrust American mediation. Part of this has to be persuading Israelis that the United States will really stand by them, and clearly in the last 6 months we've seen optimism about President Obama go into the basement.
So you said earlier that you think we're back to the Bush administration's position. A lot of people criticized President Bush for not doing as much as President Clinton had on this issue.
People did criticize President Bush. I think that there's a sense that President Obama is more engaged personally. But I think the politics in many ways are worse than they were a year ago. And the president talked in his Cairo speech about addressing this issue with all the patience that it requires. An interesting choice of words to talk about addressing it with patience. What I think he has seen is that the Israelis have a vote, the Palestinians have a vote, and while the president may want to move forward on a certain course of action, they don't necessarily have to agree, and then he has the problem of how do you actually get people to do what you want them to do. And he has that problem not only in Arab-Israeli issues, he has it in health care and a whole range of other issues in the United States.
What did you think of the tone of the speech today?
It felt a little bit like parental supervision. I thought it was a good speech, and in many ways, you know, almost harking back to the days of Adlai Stevenson, a great U.S. Representative to the United Nations, a cerebral thinker who unsuccessfully ran for president from Illinois. But I just hope in the sort of parental tone, it made a lot of sense, but I make sense to my kids, and they don't do what I want them to do all the time. And that's sort of where the logic falls apart, and you just saw that in the speech by Muammar Gaddafi right after the president ended, that things aren't done in the United Nations because they're logical. Things are done because countries have interests, and it's can be helpful to have the sort of intellectual apparatus, but ultimately you have to be able to arm twist and do some dirty politics and get things done, and the president has to get comfortable with a broad range of both speaking to people's minds and also having people say, look, this really has to happen, and we're going to make you do it.
Before you came on, we talked a bit about the anti-Americanism that the president referred to, and many people think that that was caused in part by the behavior of the Bush administration, the president himself. Do you think that was a fair a charge? And doesn't President Obama have to take steps to overcome it?
I think President Obama, the first part of his speech was taking steps to overcome it. One of the things that I think is very characteristic of President Obama is he has a knack for speaking to people with respect. And there was a way that the casualness of President Bush came across to people who were speaking to them with disrespect. So I think that certainly in the Middle East that I know well, speaking to people with respect gets you respect in return. It doesn't necessarily make people do what you need them to do. And outside of the room, outside of the respectful talk, you have to persuade people to act the way you need them to act. The other part of this as well, especially in the Middle East, is you need to get governments to do things. Governments have uncertain relationships to their public, who generally aren't the ones who put governments in office. So you can have all the support on the street you want. It doesn't necessarily get the governments to move, or you can get the governments to move, and it doesn't necessarily get you any support on the street.
John Alterman with the Bush State Department, now director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Edward Mortimer, back to you again, former speechwriter for the U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan. You mentioned the problem that President Obama has with supporters of Israel in this country. How difficult is it for him now if support for him in Israel is so low? I think the polls are showing him down around 4%.
Well, I mean, obviously that is a problem, but at the same time, I think that one can overdo the symmetry in describing this conflict. I mean, John Alterman said the Israelis have a vote, the Palestinians have a vote. The Palestinians don't really have a vote because the Palestinians have no hope of getting anything except with the support of the United States. So I think that a president who really wants to achieve something in the Middle East has got to be prepared to be a bit asymmetrical. He's got to be a bit of a Dutch uncle to the Israelis. He's got to say what Obama said, and I thought it was actually very clever the way he did the balance. I don't know if you noticed that, but he said, the United States does Israel no favors when we fail to couple an unwavering commitment to its security with an insistence that Israel respect the legitimate claims and rights of the Palestinians. And nations within this body, i.e. the UN General Assembly, do the Palestinians no favors when they choose vitriolic attacks against Israel over constructive willingness to recognize Israel's legitimacy and its right to exist in peace and security. In other words, the Israelis are my problem, and I'm going to have to deal with them, and the Palestinians are your problem, you members of the General Assembly. Oddly enough, this reminds me very much of what Kofi Annan said in his last speech on the Middle East to the Security Council in December 2006. There is a need for supporters of both sides to look hard at their own actions and rhetoric and see whether they're really helping to bring about a solution. But that means, in the case of America, you have to look at whether what you're doing really helps Israel. And I think that really to help Israel, you actually have to be prepared to say things that Israelis don't want to hear.
John Alterman, back to you. President Bush was accused of being so close to Israel that he was no longer credible as a neutral mediator between Israel and the Palestinians. Did President Obama have to overcome that image as well?
I think it's interesting because there's periodically when it comes up in American politics, people will proudly say, I'm not neutral between Israel and the Palestinians, I'm pro-Israeli, and they attack people for saying they're neutral. My recollection is Howard Dean had a problem saying he was neutral, and he wanted to be a neutral negotiator, and people said he can't be a neutral negotiator because the sides are different. But it seems to me that one of the asymmetries that Edward pointed out, and probably one of the most important ones, is that Israel is a democracy, and the Palestinian Authority has a president who was democratically elected, but the elections are being pushed off and in many ways inherited the authoritarian system of assuming a presidency from Yasser Arafat. The reality, I think, is that a president can do whatever he wants and say whatever he wants to Israel, but that has a political effect in Israel. And if you're trying to move an Israeli prime minister, you have to move the people with him or in front of him to get him to do what you need him to do. If Israelis are all hunkering down and saying there's no partner on the other side, this is not the time to make a strategic deal, the President of the United States can talk until he's blue in the face. The Israelis will not take existential risks for an elusive peace. And I think that so there's a way. It's nice to have some Palestinian public support. It's nice to support the Palestinian Authority, but unless there is Israeli political support for the President of the United States, you can't make any of this work.
John Alterman, again, formerly with the Bush administration, now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. David Bosco, let me go back to you, Assistant Professor of International Politics at American University. The book, Five to Rule Them All, the UN Security Council and the Making of the Modern World. The president got some applause today when he mentioned torture and Sudan. What about that?
Well, I think in the early part of his speech, he was very much in the mode of trying to say, look, my administration has done some things, it's taken some steps, and then he kind of went on to say, you know, the rest of the world needs to reciprocate. But torture and closing Guantanamo, or at least moving toward closing it, was part of that. And I think, you know, the applause there to me is not surprising. This was, in many ways, Obama's I'm not Bush moment, and the General Assembly, for the most part, is glad that he's not Bush. Now, on Sudan, I did think that was rather interesting. There was some applause there, because Sudan is one of those issues, you know, it's often seen as a kind of humanitarian issue, and you know, in the United States, at least, the activism around Sudan is, you know, we have to stop the genocide, we have to help the people of Sudan. At the United Nations, and particularly with a number of countries in the developing world, and particularly in Africa, it has a slightly different it's seen through a slightly different prism. And that is that this is an example of kind of the Western world trying to bully a relatively poor African state. And I think there was a lot of umbrage taken in Africa about, in particular, the indictment of the Sudanese president by the International Criminal Court, which is something that, you know, the United States has well, certainly the United States has supported the idea of war crimes charges being brought here. And so that, I thought it was interesting that there was applause from Sudan. It would be interesting, or on the Sudan question, it would be interesting to know where that applause was coming from. I suspect that may have been more kind of European than it was African in nature, although certainly there are countries in Africa that are appalled by what the Sudanese government has been doing. But Sudan is another issue on which Obama is going to have some trouble in the council. The dilemma there has been that, you know, China in particular has some strong linkages with the Sudanese government. They have, much as they have on Iran and North Korea, they've kind of acted as a brake in the Security Council to harsh sanctions. They've you know, eventually supported a peacekeeping mission, but under some very strict conditions that have limited its utility. So that kind of humanitarian question on Sudan is something where, again, the underlying realities haven't changed fundamentally.
Edward Mortimer, as chief speechwriter for the Secretary General, you certainly know the ins and outs of the UN. The president, I think, had lunch with African heads of state yesterday, did he not? Are you surprised that he brought up Sudan? Do you think that was in some way a finger in their eye?
No, not because the way he brought it up was not the way that you might expect. I think, and I think Professor Bosco drew attention to that, because this was not, you know, Colin Powell saying there's genocide and it's got to stop. It's Obama saying we support the people of Darfur and the implementation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. I mean, you know, he's not talking about, I mean, obviously, I'm not saying that he's withdrawing support for the indictment of Bashir, but what he chose to emphasize in front of the Assembly is the search for a political solution. And that, as Professor Bosco said, is much more the UN approach than it has been the approach of the American media and public opinion. So my guess is that the applause probably did come from the African part of the auditorium. But it may be that some people just applauded because they heard the word Darfur. But I think those who were listening carefully might say, well, actually, this is quite encouraging, because he is sounding reasonable, open-minded, and understands that this is a political problem that needs a political solution.
John Alterman, do you think, given the skepticism about the UN in this country, which we heard referred to earlier by Edward Mortimer, and which, of course, was somewhat embodied in the Bush administration, that any American president that really embraces the United Nations is sort of in for a disappointment, because, as you and others have pointed out, you don't always get what you want there?
Every international diplomat I know is always disappointed in the United Nations, because the United Nations can't do what you wish it could do. But that's not to say the United Nations can't do anything, and the United Nations can do a great many very useful things. The United Nations can validate what individual countries have done. It can legitimize things that people do. I think that the problem we get into in the United Nations is when we start expecting it to act like a government, and that it can't do. But I think it remains a very useful institution. I think what the president, again, needs to do is to figure out how to bridge between the high ideals and the backstreet Chicago politics that actually get things done in the world, because a lot of governments in the world, you have to deal with them the way you deal with backstreet Chicago politics, and then we can have a nice reception at the UN and put a nice little bow on it.
Professor Bosco, what was the experience of the Clinton administration with regard to the UN in this context?
Well, I think it's a bit of a cautionary tale, particularly the first term of the Clinton administration. You know, Warren Christopher, Clinton's first Secretary of State, made, I think it was his first trip out of Washington, was to UN headquarters, and there was quite a bit of talk about working through the UN and engaging, as there is now. Very quickly, the Clinton administration became quite frustrated, and the Somalia operation, which had been started under the first President Bush, went very wrong. And the Clinton administration ended up blaming, in many respects, the UN for that, quite unfairly, I think. And so relations between the Clinton administration and the UN were actually quite dire for a significant part of that first term, culminating in the effort by the Clinton administration to prevent Boutros Ghali from having a second term as Secretary General. That was a rather dramatic moment where Madeleine Albright was vetoing again and again Boutros Ghali's candidacy, totally isolated from the rest of the world and isolated from the other members of the Security Council. So it's a bit of a cautionary tale, and also a reminder that sometimes those who have the highest hopes for the institution can be the most cruelly disappointed because they believe in the institution. They get quite hurt and angry when things don't work out.
All right, a cautionary tale. We will end with that, and on that note, and thank you all very much for being with us. David Bosco, assistant professor at American University, author of Five to Rule Them All, the UN Security Council and the Making of the Modern World. John Alterman, director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in the State Department during the first administration of George W. Bush. Edward Mortimer, a senior vice president of the Salzburg Global Seminar, formerly chief speechwriter for UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Thank you all very much for being with us. The UN has a presence in Afghanistan, but the war there is being conducted by the U.S. and NATO. President Karzai didn't join the other heads of state in New York. Questions about his re-election have divided UN officials. Now there are reports that President Obama is rethinking America's basic strategy in Afghanistan. We'll hear about that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
We're on Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In today's speech, the president said a focused goal of the United States is to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda and its extremist allies.
In Afghanistan and Pakistan, we and many nations here are helping these governments develop the capacity to take the lead in this effort, while working to advance opportunity and security for their people.
As to Afghanistan, the U.S. Commanding General Stanley McChrystal says an increase in troop strength is the only way to win. His lengthy memo to that effect was leaked to the Washington Post this week. But it's reported today that President Obama is exploring alternatives, including Vice President Biden's plan to scale back American forces. Rajiv Chandrasekharan is senior correspondent for the Washington Post. It's always good to have you on our program.
Good to be on with you, Warren.
What is this all about? What is Vice President Biden exploring, and does it suggest a reversal of a kind in Afghanistan?
Well, Vice President Biden is advocating a position that he's actually held and advocated now for some months, dating back all the way to the beginning of the Obama administration, which is that the broader counterinsurgency mission, as envisaged by not just General McChrystal, but by other senior members of Obama's national security team, would just be too resource-intensive, have too small a chance of success. And as a consequence, what the United States should do is narrow its mission in Afghanistan simply to focus on taking out senior al-Qaeda operatives that might seek to return and set up bases of operation in Afghanistan.
Is the real concern, I think Vice President Biden said this while he was running for president on his part, is it really Pakistan?
Yes, and he believes that the operations in Afghanistan actually distract from the problem in Pakistan and potentially make the situation there worse. People on the other side of this argument, however, note that if Afghanistan were to slip into a worse state of chaos as U.S. and NATO forces were to withdraw, that could potentially further destabilize Pakistan by giving militants who are in Pakistan a safe haven next door in Afghanistan from which to continue to mount attacks against the Pakistani government.
And is the particular concern about Pakistan based on the fact that it has nuclear weapons?
Well, that certainly escalates the stakes greatly. Certainly the nuclear component, it's a much larger country. Its proximity to India, all of that makes it, in the eyes of some on President Obama's national security team, including President Biden, the biggest challenge and the most important challenge to deal with.
Well, now, the president was reportedly at the UN going to talk with various allies about Afghanistan. Is he now not in a position to do that if his own administration is debating basic strategy?
Well, I think that obviously he still wants to continue to engage with the leaders of a number of countries that have troops there and hopefully will continue to have them there for the foreseeable future. I think what the White House is now seeking to do is to go back and question some of its core assumptions. The White House did put forward an Afghanistan-Pakistan strategy back in March that did endorse a counterinsurgency mission, much along the lines of what General McChrystal is calling for. But what has happened since then, obviously, have been the Afghan presidential elections, which were riddled with fraud, and now facing a reality where the incumbent, Hamid Karzai, may well continue on in office, but under a huge cloud of illegitimacy. There's been weakening support among leading Democrats on Capitol Hill. American public opinion is softening with regard to support for the war effort there. And there has been increased skepticism among some of the European allies, including some that President Obama will be engaging with in New York over the next day. So taken all together, the White House is now saying, well, we need to step back and look at, as Afghanistan has changed, is the original strategy that was articulated 6 months ago the best way forward, or should we recalibrate? And, of course, Vice President Biden has his particular point of view, but we should also note that Defense Secretary Bob Gates, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and other senior members of President Obama's National Security Council also have a seat at that table and have their own strong views about which way the administration should proceed.
Well, now we have the leaking of this document signed off on by General McChrystal to your paper. We have the neocon organization, to the extent that they're organized, sending letters to the president urging him to stay the course in Afghanistan. It would appear that there is a major confrontation going on about the policy in Afghanistan.
Well, it's certainly the publication of McChrystal's confidential assessment in the pages of my newspaper has changed some of the dynamics of this debate. It has given new ammunition to congressional Republicans and others to lobby for increasing resources there. And on the other hand, it has given new ammunition to people on the other side of this issue to argue that this may well be a lost cause. They point to some of the language that McChrystal uses, and they cite it as evidence of the fact that this is an incredibly difficult proposition, and the chances of success may be fairly small. So everybody's sort of taking a little something out of this document for their own purposes.
He didn't necessarily say you're going to win with more troops. He just said you're not going to win unless you have more troops. What about the clout of Vice President Biden? Is that on the line?
Well, Vice President Biden made these arguments earlier this year during the first strategy review, and he lost out at that point. Now he's making them again, And it's going to be interesting to see whether it generates any more traction. It's not at all clear that Biden's view will win the day. I think it may generate a little bit more support given some of the other changes that have occurred since then. But you've got a lot of people in the military hierarchy, folks at the State Department and elsewhere, who are still pretty supportive of a broader counterinsurgency mission. Part of this whole reexamination process may well be an effort by the White House to try to show to congressional Democrats and other critics of any escalation in Afghanistan that they are taking their skepticism very seriously, and they're not just going to reflexively give the commander on the ground what he wants without a lot of due diligence and a lot of discussion and debate within the White House.
Okay. Extraordinarily important to debate going on, and thanks so much for clarifying it. Again, Rajiv Chandrasekaran is a senior correspondent for The Washington Post. Good to have you back.
Good to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Today's program produced by Andrea Brody with Sonia Geis and Gary Scott. Technical director is Wesley Roberts. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/to the point. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.